morning, everyone, and welcome to Liberty Talk Radio, America's libertarian voice and independent streaming internet radio station, available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, from our studio in Tulsa, Oklahoma, to around the world. I'm your host, Joe Cristiano, and this is your antidote to popular talk radio. This broadcast is being brought to you live on Monday morning, March 22nd. It is now 7:01 a.m. Central Daylight Time in the good old USA. Folks, it's time for us to take back control of our government now before this bureaucratic, oversized, and self-serving federal government starves us of our property, our freedom, our rights, and our liberty. To do this, we must shed conventional thinking regarding our political structure. We need to be revolutionaries in thought, dissidents in action. Only after we recognize what our government is doing to our freedom and our Constitution will we start taking it back. And this program is just about that. Well, good morning, everyone. I'm going to check to see if everything is working on our new system we just set up. And it looks like we have a go, hopefully. We're going to have this morning. Oh, by the way, before we start our program, during our live broadcast, we invite you to call 646-652-4620. That's 646-652-4620. Send us your email to comments@libertytalkradio.com. I also encourage you to get educated on economic issues. Go to Andy Sutton's website, sutton-associates.net. In his bi-weekly newsletter, Andy discusses economic issues and how they affect you. You can also listen to Andy's commentary on contraryinvestorscafe.com. Lastly, I would also like to remind our listeners to subscribe to our reminder service by visiting our website and clicking on the subscribe icon. And I'll bet this is who's on the air right now. Good morning, Andy. Is that you?
It is, Joe. How you doing?
Fine. Finally. Boy, it's been a long time trying to set this broadcast up. I cannot believe it. Do you know, this station has been down for 2 months, and physically I have been down for almost 2 months. It has been such a long haul, and I'm finally recuperating. How are you feeling these days?
I'm doing well, Joe. I was concerned when I got your last email. You said you had been down with the flu or flu-like symptoms or something along those lines. I hope you're feeling better.
Well, I am, but I'm still a little weak. I had a bad case of asthmatic bronchitis, whatever that means.
Oh, wow.
Had difficulty doing anything at all, lost all my initiative to do anything. It was just, and I'm working out of it. I'm still, believe it or not, I think it really took a toll on me, and I'm working out of it very slowly. This morning, I feel particularly well. I don't know why. I mean, maybe the weather is getting better, and that's helping, because the weather here in Tulsa has been gloomy, damp, rainy, snowy, windy, and just horrible. I mean, I like the cold weather. I'm a cold weather guy, but this weather has just been awful. I mean, if you didn't have arthritis, come to Tulsa. We have plenty of it for you. I tell you, that's the way you feel. Anyway, well, Andy,
I tell you, I've got a friend one state south of you down in Texas, and he was telling me that this was the gloomiest, dampest, coldest winter that he's ever experienced down there, and he's been in there for about, oh, I don't know, 60, 65 years. He said it's just been awful.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I was riding my motorcycle the other day. I stopped at a light, and there was a break in the clouds, and the sun came out, and it shined through my helmet. And I had this biggest smile on my face that I saw the sun. I felt so good. And then it went away, and all of a sudden, I retreated back into my somber, you know, feeling. But that's the way it's been. And it's been like this every day for over three months, probably 4 months. And it's unusual because we don't get many clouds here in Oklahoma. You know, we're the open plains place, you know, where the skies are clear typically. And this has really put a downer and a damper on everyone. Well, anyway, we have so much to talk about. Enough about the weather. Andy, it's really such a pleasure to hear your voice. I mean that sincerely. I want to thank you so much for your effort in what you do in your newsletters, both the one that you publish, which is a free newsletter, and the My Two Cents, which is your subscription newsletter, both of which I read word for word every time. I can promise you, I don't have them memorized, but I do read word for word, and I find them incredibly insightful, and I appreciate that.
Oh, well, I appreciate the compliment, and it's a pleasure to be back on again, and it's good to hear your voice, and I'm glad to hear that you got your health going in the right direction, and the studio as well. I know you were having some really bad technical issues. It's great to be back here.
Well, you know, well, now that the health care bill has been passed, I told my wife this morning we must really start taking care of ourselves. We have to really watch ourselves, because there will be a day when we need something and the government's going to say, well, Mr. and Mrs. So-and-so, you know, you're, you know, 68 or 70 years old and little Melissa here is only 5. You don't expect us to use our funds to take care of you after you've lived such a good life and let this poor little girl suffer. I mean, I can see that happening. In fact, I can feel it happening, and I don't know if I'm just an alarmist, a negative-thinking person, but I really fear that they've looked at the demand side only and not the supply side, and we are in for some really incredibly surprisingly rough times.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more, and you know, all things else aside, what we saw in this bill, and it was a huge bill. It's impossible for anybody really to read 2,700 pages of text, comments, and what have you, and actually comprehend every last piece of it. But just from the skimming that I did based on some keyword searches, there's a lot of bad stuff in this bill. And you know, getting back to what you said about you know, choosing who gets care and who doesn't, all the ingredients are in the mixing bowl for that now. It'll be up to human devices and human nature as to how that all plays out. But I tend to think like you do, Joe. I am one of those people that I don't even know if I hope for the best anymore. I guess I hope for the mediocre and expect the worst, because that seems to be what we've been getting recently. And I don't think that there's a lot of people that can really argue with that kind of a mindset on this healthcare thing. And I think the economics of it is just, it's just ridiculous. Yeah. We're just going to pile more debt on our already overburdened nation, our economic system. It's going to require tax increases. I don't know if you took a look at the president's budget proposal, but buried in there was essentially means testing for Medicare. So it's all coming. I mean, this something's got to give here. There's too much money going out, not nearly enough coming in. And you know, the funny thing is, even if they raised corporate taxes and took 100% of corporate profits and 100% of what you and I and everyone else in this country makes, it's still not enough to close the gap. So yeah, we're at a situation now where it's too late to pay the debt off. It's not going to happen.
Yeah.
So we kind of have to move away from that and move away from demanding that government reform itself to pay off the debt, because we know they're not going to do that. And we kind of have to move towards damage control here, in my opinion. All right, well, what's going to happen because of this? You know, what are the likely outcomes that are going to take place because we've chosen this path? I think the path is pretty much carved in stone.
Right.
I don't see us getting to a situation where we pay this off.
You know what's surprising is that something so that affects the nation in the way this health care bill does can be passed by a simple majority. You would think it would require at least 2/3, where you would get a real consensus that this is what the people want. But to skim through by a couple of votes and say, now we have this, you bifurcate the country. I mean, you have, first of all, from what I understand, from all the polls, a vast majority of people are saying no to healthcare. This healthcare, well, they call it reform. They say it's like, you know, I won already. You know, it's like going into a fight and saying, I'm the winner, now let's fight. You know, reform, we don't know if it's reform. It could be regression, which if they called it healthcare regression, I'm sure it wouldn't have passed, and it could have had the same wording in it. That's what bothers me, is we prejudice the whole thing by to contaminate it with words, and then we say, well, are you against reform? Whenever people ask me, they say, are you against reform, health care? Are you for this health care bill? I'd say my standard answer is I haven't read it. Have you? And it stops them in their track. They go, well, it's going to make it – have you read it? No. Well, I'm so, until I can sit down and read it. And I'm not smart enough to sit down and comprehend it. So I will not read it because I will not understand it. And if I'm not smart enough, I can guarantee you those bureaucrats in Washington aren't smart enough. Anyway, but I
don't think half of these guys. Yeah, I don't think half of these guys even really understand what they voted yes or no for. There's no way anybody. I mean, they all have a staff, and I understand that, and they have, you know, squads of lawyers that work for them. But I don't know that there's any way to properly assimilate and coalesce that much information, and so that somebody can get a good enough picture of what is going. You know, the Constitution is 4,500 words, give or take.
Right. Yeah, right.
And this thing is this thing alone is 2,700 pages. If you need 2,700 pages to do something, you're doing something that you don't want people to know about.
That's
pretty much my opinion on all of these bills.
Yeah. Well, you know, what's interesting is that the questions that are never asked. Oh, by the way, before we go any further, my screens that I have now, and I have several screens up, Andy, are acting a little funny. I mean, they're blipping and things like that. I hope everything is going fine. In the event that we get cut off, I mean, I will reset everything and just call back, okay? I'm not hanging up on you. I mean, I just fear because I have no experience with this new system. All right. What bothers me is that the questions that are not asked by any media is when they start the dialogue or the conversation or the debate or the interview regarding healthcare, no one says, by the way, who wrote it? Simple question. Who wrote the bill? Well, Congress. All right. Who in Congress wrote the bill? We don't know. Well, you think these congressmen who are bureaucrats who do nothing but go around sitting down every night reading writing word for, you think they're capable of writing a 2,700-page bill? No, of course they're not. Well, who wrote it then? Well, they have staff doing it. You mean they hire these kids out of college to be their assistants, and they are capable of writing a 2,700? I said, please, but don't insult my intelligence. Who wrote the bill? And they cannot. But when you start thinking about it, you get to know the answer to that. And once you know the answer, you know that there are people making big money on this. The people who are making money on the bill are the people who wrote it. Very simple. Very simply said.
Yeah.
Anyway, but let's get away from that because right now my blood pressure is about 210 over 180, and I got to get it down a little bit, Andy, okay? Andy,
oh, that's all? I would have thought it would have been 300 by this point.
Oh, I tell you, you know, I anticipate. And another interesting factoid, if you will. Isn't it interesting, whenever there's a very controversial issue, they always vote on it on Christmas Eve, you know, Sunday afternoon. It's never Tuesday at 2 o'clock. Why is that? Is there something that, if it's controversial, they do it some oddball time? They can never do it during working hours?
This is because we have a bunch of cowards in Washington, D.C. This is my opinion now. We have a bunch of cowards. And they're doing things that they know the people don't want. They're doing things that they know are, in this case, at least skirting the law as it's laid out by the Constitution. You know, you've got a version issue here. You know, this was not conferenced like a normal bill would be conferenced. All right, we're going to put through a package of fixes later that's going to make it the same. Well, that's not what the Constitution says needs to be done. So they broke the law, really. I mean, let's not mince words.
Right, absolutely.
This is the same thing that went on with the Federal Reserve Act, which you're referring to on Christmas Eve.
Right.
And a lot of these other things, they pass them in the middle of the night. This goes on here in Pennsylvania all the time. You know, anytime they want to do something that they know is unpopular, they'll do it at 2 o'clock in the morning, like a few years ago. Our state legislature voted itself massive pay raises, and they did it at literally 2:30 in the morning. And this is
they were working
the pattern,
so hard, Andy. They worked all the way through the night. They worked all the way through the night, Andy. They're working so hard. They deserve that raise. Oh, gosh.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Well, actually, the economics, the healthcare issue speaks to the economic issue. And your newsletter does a great job, or you do a great job, in taking the macroeconomic viewpoint, which is I like to read. You know, the nitty gritty is a lot of noise typically, or day to day, This, I assume, is just going to exasperate things. I don't know how the market's going to take this, which I really don't care. And I don't know how the world is going to take this, how foreign nations will look at this as something that may weaken the dollar, strengthen the dollar, or whatever the case may be. Why don't we just start by taking some macroeconomic a viewpoint of what is going on economically, and we'll take it from there, Andy, and I'll let you take off from there.
Well, I mean, the first thing I think is important for people to notice and pay attention to is the fact that the job situation isn't getting any better. There's last month's unemployment report, and I wrote about this, and I'm sure you saw it,
right.
Advertised that, that we only lost 36,000 jobs, and the politicians were jumping all over that, and you know, first of all, losing 36,000 jobs, there's nothing good about that. But, you know, this has been the pattern. We try to spin less negative news into being good news.
Right.
But the thing is when you actually look at how that number was arrived at and the adjustments that were made, they added 100,000 fictitious jobs and just assumed that these phantom new businesses created 100,000 jobs. And they do this every month. It's called the birth-death model.
Yeah, but how do they do that? I mean, where do they get these 100,000 fictitious jobs? I mean, where's the assumption come from? Do you know?
I believe it's basically capricious and arbitrary. There's never been any substantiation provided for any kind of methodology, any type of survey methodology that's been used to arrive at this. It's pretty much been arbitrary. So I think it's politically driven. I mean, this birth-death model never removes jobs. Businesses never fail at a greater rate than they're created, you know, if you look at this. It's just ridiculous.
Okay.
You know, so they pull these jobs out of thin air. It's kind of like the Federal Reserve's version of, you know, monetary creation. You know, we just pull the jobs out of thin air and we say they exist.
Right.
And so there was not exactly 97,000 of those, if you want to be precise. And they ignore the fact that we need to create 145,000 to 155,000 jobs every month just to break even because of population growth, you know, people entering
right.
the workforce
right.
and so forth. And when you take a look at the fact that 68,000 jobs that were created, I'm just going through February here, 68,000 jobs that were created, quote-unquote, were temp jobs, 18,000 were census jobs, which we know that's not going to last very long. That'll be over in a couple months.
Right.
You know, but the media looks at this and they say, oh, this is great because these are all new jobs and these are permanent. And they're not. They're temp jobs.
Right.
And, I mean, yeah, a temp job is better than no job at all, but they certainly can't look at those the same way as you would look at a permanent position. You can't do that, and
right.
be honest.
Right.
Something else that I thought was really alarming in that report was the fact that 31,000 state and local government workers lost their jobs in February. And what that's telling me is these are jobs that were sacrosanct. They were always everybody always bashed the local government worker,
right.
but everybody was jealous because they wanted that job because of the
that's
job
right.
security.
Right.
And these are the people that had jobs for life. They had great pensions, great benefits. These people are getting laid off now, Joe. This
right.
this crisis is stretching its fingers into the state and local system. We've got pension plans from sea to shining sea that are busted out. Broke. The demographics are terrible, and they're not getting better. And then you have the whole situation. 2008 stock market rout came at the exact precise wrong time for all of these pension plans. And I don't know if you saw this, but I'm kind of getting off of my track here. But
no, please do.
The FDIC is going to actually start petition pension funds to invest in some of these busted out banks
yes.
that they've been closing
right.
because the FDIC is busted out too. I mean, it's just, this is systemic. And this is something I've been trying to get people to understand for a while now is that, you know, I don't care what the media says, you know, 36,000 jobs. No, it was more like we lost 350,000 when
right.
you take all these adjustments out
right.
that they do. That's how bad it was.
Right.
That's just 1 month. Now, granted, it was closer to a million a few months ago.
Right.
So, yeah, 350,000 is definitely better than 850,000. Yeah, I understand that. But 350,000, we're nowhere near getting back on even keel here.
Right.
And a lot of these jobs that are being created, they're temp jobs, and you can see the government's just stepping in with tax credits now to try to induce firms to hire. Firms aren't going to hire for a $1,000 tax break. I mean, who do these guys think they're kidding?
Right.
You know, these businessmen know a lot more than these bureaucrats.
Right.
And it comes back to what you said.
Right.
I mean, that's one of the things I think is the most important right here. Is without jobs, we're going nowhere.
Right.
You know, it doesn't matter what Ben Bernanke says. You know, jobless recovery, it's not going to happen.
Yeah. You know, just let me take a break for a second. Ladies and gentlemen, you are listening to Liberty Talk Radio. I'm your host, Joe Cristiano. As our guest, we have Andy Sutton, Chief of Market Strategist for Sutton & Associates, and we're talking about the economy. Our call-in number is 646-652-4620, or send us your email anytime to comments at libertytalkradio.com. Milton Friedman visited, this is when he was alive, obviously, and many years ago, visited China, and he had someone accompany him, and they were showing him this massive construction project, and he noticed that they were, I don't know how many people, but apparently a large number of workers with shovels and picks, and he turned around to his guide and said, you have so much heavy-duty earth-moving equipment that can do this so quickly and efficiently, why don't you use those instead of these? And the gentleman, his guide said, well, he said, then these people would be out of work. He said, we do this to create jobs. And Milton Friedman turns around to him and said, then why don't you just give them all spoons? And his point is, it's really not, I mean, it is jobs. The end result is jobs, but the objective is not jobs. The objective is to produce something. Producing something creates jobs. I mean, we can create jobs. I mean, it's when they're building a highway, instead of using a bulldozer, give everyone spoons. We can put 500 people out on a road where only one person would be normal. You know, we can do that. And that was his point. And I think it's so well to give them all spoons. So my progressive friends who say, well, we can't do that because it'll eliminate jobs, then give them all spoons. I always think that in my head. Anyway, I interrupted what you were saying. I thought it was just terrific because it is. That's exactly what the situation's like right now. This morning, surprisingly, I heard that two large companies, and you know, and I cannot remember, they're in every mall in the United States, two large, very well-known companies, and I can't remember which ones they were, are thinking about closing their mall locations or reducing their size. Now, the commercial market, I understand, is also something that was something we have to watch for, because the commercial real estate market can have as devastating, I understand, or even more devastating effect than the residential market if there's a commercial real estate mortgage collapse as well. Can you comment on that?
Well, that's already happening. The mortgage situation on the commercial side, It's not as well publicized as the residential side, just because people don't understand it as well. But you didn't necessarily have the same classifications of loans, you know, as we would call them subprime and prime and alt A, like you had in residential. But there's a lot of risky loans in commercial real estate, and the National Credit Bureau here, National Credit Review, they did a survey. And they tagged substandard or doubtful loans or loans that are going to generate a loss at around $447 billion. And that's tripled over the past year. And it now constitutes about 16% of all of the loans that they've looked at. And if you take a look, that was 5.8% of the loans back in 2008. So in 2 years, it's almost tripled. So we're looking at a situation where this is a ticking time bomb, in my opinion, that's about to go off. And it's going to go off slowly. It's going to go off over the next 5 years or so. A lot of these loans are spread out between now and 2014, where there's balloon payments due or whatever the situation may be. And a lot of these loans are generally structured a little bit differently than retail loans, or retail mortgage loans, I should say, for residential folks. But this is where it comes back to jobs. If you have a situation where most of these commercial real estate loans, you know, shopping malls, strip malls, these types of things, office buildings and that kind of stuff, if you don't have the economy creating jobs, people aren't going to spend money in these retail centers. And if people aren't spending money in the retail centers, it's an obvious domino effect. These stores are not going to do well. Some are going to close. You know, and it may not be that the whole chain goes bankrupt, but you take a look at what Starbucks did a year and a half or so ago. They closed about 600 or 800 stores or whatever it was, and they scuttled about that many more. They just decided not to go ahead and build them.
Right.
So, the chains themselves may not go bankrupt necessarily, but you see some of these chains start cutting back 25, 30, 40% of their stores. All of a sudden, now you've got empty storefronts. those storefronts aren't generating any income. All of a sudden, you've got mortgage pools that are starting to become compromised, and it becomes very similar to what happened in the residential market.
Right.
And you don't have, at least not right now, the amount of derivatives out there on these loans that you did on the residential side, but there are credit default swaps and those types of things. And, you know, the interesting thing about this is 2 years ago, about, you know, a year and three quarters ago now, we nearly had a collapse of the financial system because of the bad behavior, the malfeasance, and general wanton risk-taking of banks. And what's been not well publicized at all is that they are back to 100%, 110% business as usual before any of this even started. Mm-hmm. They're taking as much risk, if not more, than they were taking 2 years ago. So there's been no lesson learned, and we knew this was going to happen. You and I talked about this.
Yeah.
These guys are not going to learn a lesson. They know that they can just run to Congress and threaten a massive depression if they're allowed to go bankrupt, and they're going to keep taking risks. So we're setting the table for another blow-up here, and it's exactly what's going to happen. The blow-ups are coming more often, and each one gets progressively bigger, and that's a function of not only human nature, but it's a function of a broken monetary system, too. So, I mean, yeah, we're going to have another problem, and it's going to be bigger than the last one.
Yeah. Actually, the banks taking a risk are, in effect, taking a risk initially, but they're not taking any risk at all, in effect, because they know they're going to get bailed out. So it's a zero risk as far as they're concerned. That's why they're doing it. And that's what people have to understand, is that the banks are not doing anything that you and I probably would do. I mean, if we knew, you know, if I went to Vegas to gamble, and I knew if I lost, all I do is go to the window and they replenish me, you know, hey, I'll go to the crap table. I'd bet on all the 80-1 shots. What the heck, you know? And just have a grand old time. The thing is, I'm not playing with my own money. And that's what's happening with the banks right now. Now, I understand, and I think it may have been your newsletter, where they had mentioned, where it was mentioned that the banks are lending not as much as they used to. It's down slightly. It's not all down to that much. However, all of the money that has been given, the trillions that were given into the banking system, that should have amounted, I think, nationwide, there typically is like $2 billion sitting in the back rooms in banks. Now there's over $1 trillion, but it's not going anywhere. So all that money is just sitting there in the banks, and it's not going out, plus lending is down a little bit. So that's putting a big clog in the system. The banks say, not going to lend it out. So it's kind of strange what they're doing. They're just tying up loans that they know they're going to get bailed out on, but others they're not. And I don't understand how they choose one or the other. And if they know they're going to be bailed out, why are they sitting on this $1 trillion in the back room?
Well, really what you've got, yeah, and this is something I talked about a number of months ago, they've got upwards of $1 trillion sitting in reserves at the Fed right now, earning 15 basis points. And there's a couple of reasons they could be doing this. The first thing is that they could be preparing for the next leg of the crisis. I give that kind of a low weighting just because of the fact that the bailout mentality is now firmly in place. They know what to do to get another bailout. They know that there's no reforms have been done. So they know how this game works now. We've seen the movie before. All they have to do is, oh, the whole world's going to collapse and everything's going to be terrible and there's going to be a massive depression. You need to give us, $1.5 trillion yesterday. And they know it's going to happen. And so I kind of give that a low weighting. What I think is going on here, I think you're seeing these banks hoard money for consolidation. You know, so big banks can gobble up other big banks. I mean, these guys are constantly cannibalizing each other.
Right, right.
These guys are constantly trying to devour one another. You just take a look at the Lehman situation. You know, back in June of 2008, there was a Lehman whistleblower that got fired after going to Lehman's auditor and saying, hey, these repo 105s are going to cause a lot of problems, and we don't think they're even legal.
Right.
And the auditor turned a blind eye, the regulators turned a blind eye. But the point here is that Bank of America and Merrill Lynch at the time, they were also making complaints to the regulator saying, hey, Lehman's cheating. But the problem, Joe, is they're doing the same thing. They're all doing this. Every last one of them is doing the same thing. And the problem is, I don't have any problem with somebody taking leverage and taking risk if they're the only one that goes down because of it.
Oh, yeah, right.
But
they accept
you have
the
a
risk
situation
for it, yeah.
here these banks are basically putting the entire system at risk. They're right. taking on leverage and they're taking on risk, but they're basically putting everybody else behind the eight ball, and that shouldn't happen. The system should not be allowed to do that. And there's a number right. of reforms that you know are possible that could alleviate this situation, but Wall Street really, you know, as far as I'm concerned, they own Congress. I mean, let's be honest here.
Oh, yeah, right.
I think they pretty much own Congress, and I don't think you're going to see any, there's going to be a lot of saber rattling. You know, Dodd's got a bill going forward now, whatever. I don't think you're going to see any meaningful reform that's going to seriously dip into their profits or their behavior. I think that's just the way it is. I don't see meaningful reform in the future as far as the banks go.
Yeah. Well, I've always looked at what is going on in the past 10 years. And I've been thinking this way for a long time. I don't know what woke me up. I have no idea. And I really think it was a biking buddy of mine one time about 1998 when we sat down, we had coffee, a whole group of us were going bicycling, and they start talking about the economy. And he said something that turned a switch on me, you know. And but I looked at the impoverishment of America. If you look at the 1990s, I mean the 1900s, and you look at forward and you see what happens to America as we go along. I went to a car show this weekend and they had some Model A's there, and the price on the Model A's, they had the original selling price, they were between $450 to $625. That was a price range. Now these were everything from sedans to pickup trucks and whatever. Now understand that those were the high-tech machines of the day. So they were equivalent, in a sense, to what we have today, although we have airbags and whatever. But back then, what they had, that was really super high-tech stuff. People marveled at that stuff. So they're sort of equivalent in a way. And yet, you look at a truck for $600, and then I went to go look at a four-door Ford, four-wheel drive, you know, it was like $69,000, you know. Now, I know I wouldn't buy the $69,000, but you know if you go to the dealership, it's going to cost you $30,000 or something like that. And you think from, you know, $600 to $30,000, something happened to the dollar because we went from high-tech to high-tech, but different high-tech. And, you know, it's amazing the impoverishment that we've seen in America. We went from people refinancing their homes to refinancing their credit cards to not paying their credit cards to cashing in their annuities, you know, reverse mortgages. I mean, if you just look at the commercials, I mean, it just shows you how we impop. Back in the old days, I remember I used to go look at homes when I lived in New York, and looking at a house for $17,000 was big time at the time, $17,000. But they wanted $3,000 or $4,000 down, and they did an investigation like the FBI did on you. Andy, there's something.
Yeah.
We're just not there anymore. I mean, we are just an impoverished nation. Have you ever been?
You know what? You just did a really good job of explaining the fall of the dollar in terms of what it took to buy a top-of-the-line piece of equipment, you know, some date certain in the past, and what it does, what it takes now. And that really, you know what? That puts it in a nutshell. You put the cheese on the cracker right there, and that's really the way it is.
Yeah.
And that's something that people need to look at. There's a frightening statistic that I saw just a couple of days ago. Almost 45% of workers right now have less than $10,000 saved for retirement.
Yeah.
And it's because of this. It's because of exactly what you just said.
Yeah. I know people who work for my company. I still own it. You know, I just do the financial work now. Most will not participate in an IRA where they get free money. And I tell them, I say, every year I have to go through this. I go, gentlemen, you don't understand. You can put $25 a month in. I am going to give you an additional 3% of your salary. I'm going to give to you, you know, free of charge. It's yours, this, you know, and it's deferred tax. They won't do it. It is amazing.
Huh.
I need the money. I need the money. I need the money. You know, and we pay pretty well. We don't pay minimum wage or anything. We pay well, and anytime the company has extra money, we give bonuses out all the time. And they know that, and that's why they stay, because they know that, you know, I make much less than they do, because I don't need the money, and it goes to them, and it works out very well that way. I don't care. You know, I don't need the money. You know, so it's interesting that they won't do it, and one of them happens to be my son.
Huh.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
I mean, I hate to admit that. I mean, believe me, it literally, it really rips at me for me to say, and one of them is my son. It actually rips at me to say that.
I had a chance recently to speak at a local school, and we were talking about a bunch of different things, some business startup topics, and the conversation kind of came around to this idea of saving, and it's very pathetic and pitiful what a lousy job our education system does at training new entrants to the workforce. I mean, let's be honest, these kids are going to be new entrants into the workforce.
Absolutely.
We do a lousy job of teaching them the merits of saving. We spend so much time worried about narcissism, consumption,
right,
and all, and how consumption is a good thing, and how to manage multiple credit cards. Hey, how about this? How about learn to live on without using credit cards?
Yeah.
How about adjusting your lifestyle so that you can use a credit card as a convenient tool to get yourself a few days of interest-free financing every month, and maybe a rewards program and nothing more.
Right.
Why do we have to teach people to live under the chains of debt? And
that's
that
right,
is something that really, really grabs me and just twists me.
Right.
That we don't advocate saving anymore, Joe. It's all about debt. You look at the TV commercials, mortgage, this debt, that debt, this other kind of debt, and we've got nice little fancy, real cute names for it now, and it's very special what we've done with debt, but we've made it into something that should be embraced instead of something that should be treated with a healthy dose of respect, because it really, you know, the encumbrances that it puts upon people, or people don't understand it oftentimes until it's too late.
Well, we don't have an education system. We have people being educated by television. Our school systems are broken. They're not worth the damn. I would advocate kids stay home. Don't go to school. You'll learn more. Even if you stay home and do nothing but read comic books, at least you're reading something. Going to school is a waste of time because you're not learning to read. It's a sham, because what happens when they watch TV? They see an ad on TV where someone is mired in debt. And the language is such is that this person had nothing to do with it. It's like you wake up one morning and you get a pimple on your nose and you don't know where it came from. You know, I mean, it's like, how did this happen? If this could happen to you. If this happens to you, come to Debt Relief Incorporated and we'll make sure that you don't have to pay the debt. And not only are we telling that this is something that's inflicted upon you, that you are totally, it's an involuntary act, but then there's someone out there who's going to take it away from you and wipe your slate clean. What type of education? I mean, you know, it's like someone getting up in the morning who's 380 pounds, but only 5'10", looking in the mirror and went, oh my God, I got fat. I mean, no, this happened over 30 years. It didn't happen Wednesday morning, you know, and it's almost the same thing. Like, this guy got fat. How did that happen? Well, look at what he does every day. And this is the mentality that we have today. We're going to stop for station identification just for a second. Folks, this is Liberty Talk Radio. I'm your host, Joe Cristiano. We are pleased to have Andy Sutton, Chief Market Strategist for Sutton & Associates. We're talking about the economy, and I am talking too much. So please call in 646-652-4620, 646-652-4620. Send in your comments at any time to comments@libertytalkradio.com. Andy, have you ever been in a ghost mall?
I have.
Oh, you have?
I was in Baltimore last summer with a friend of mine, and we kind of did the walking tour. He's a government worker in D.C., so he gets primo parking preferences, or whatever you want to call them. So we did kind of the walking tour of the whole nation's capital, and we were in Baltimore and all over the place, and we put a lot of mileage on our sneakers that weekend. And yeah, I saw a ghost mall. There was a number of empty fronts, and you know, just not a lot of people around, and the people that were around weren't spending money. Yeah, we've got something similar going on locally, you know, where you can go to the mall and there's a lot of people walking around, but I do what's called a bag survey.
Me
I'll
too.
Walk into the mall, and this is probably really twisted.
I know. I do the same thing. My wife and I did the same thing, but go ahead. I'm sorry.
I'll go in and I'll count 50 people. And
that's
I'll,
right.
I'll keep track of how many of them have back.
I thought I was the only person doing that. That's terrific. I thought I was the only person in the world did that. Right before Christmas, my wife and I were in the mall, and she says, what are you doing? I said, I'm counting bags. And it's so funny that you mentioned that. She says, what are you counting bags for? I said, well, I remember when I was a kid, a few days before Christmas, you couldn't see the people's faces because they had boxes and bags all over the place. I mean, they couldn't carry the stuff. I said, no one has anything in their hands. They don't even have their hands. It's their girlfriend's other hand, you know, and they're just walking. No one has any packages. And my wife looked around and she says, you're right, there are no packages. I did the same thing.
That's well, you know, in all fairness, I think a lot of that is people have gotten into this mindset now where they might go shopping in the mall and then buy online.
That's
true. Let's be honest.
Yeah.
I mean, you can spend $5,000 now and put it into a small bag. You know, you start buying iPods and iPhones
right. Yeah.
and all this
That's
other
true.
Kind of, you know, micro technology that we have available. You can rack up huge bills and not really have a lot of packages to show for it.
Yeah. That's
true. The thing is, and this kind of leads into the second thing that I wanted to kick around with you, and that's the whole consumer situation, the retail, sales, whatever you want to call it, personal consumption expenditures, that whole situation. That's not really getting any better either, and there's a great deal of subterfuge that goes on in a lot of these reports, and that's kind of what I've been reduced to lately, Joe. I'm sure you've taken notice. I spend more time recently trying to debunk a lot of these reports and just go through all of the government reporting bureaus are starting to change methodologies now. Labor Department's changed their methodology. BLS has changed some of their methodologies with regards to how unemployment is reported. The Commerce Department has changed some of their methodologies with regards to GDP. Instead of using 2,000 chain dollars now, they're using 2,005 chain dollars, which is basically falsely putting upward pressure on GDP just because of the inflationary situation. So you're seeing all these modifications to methodologies, and what you have here is a result where the numbers that are being reported look better than they really are. And media will focus on the headline number, retail sales, and say, oh, retail sales, ex autos, was up 0.9% in February. Well, you know, if the headline number would have been up 0.9%, next autos would have been 0.3%, then they would have used the headline number.
Right.
So you can't rely on the mainstream media to do an honest job of reporting. It's not in their best interest. And you have to really look at that, because look at who owns the majority of these media companies. There's very close ties to Wall Street. And let's be honest, Wall Street does much better when there's optimism. So you've got basically paid cheerleading squads for Wall Street in the form of the mainstream media. So, I mean, that's really become a big piece of my job here recently, is just trying to debunk all of these government reports. And the retail sales one is very important, because consumer spending, you know, was about 72% of our economy. It's down to about 65% now.
I see.
And what you have is you have the government stepping in with borrowed money, 50 cents on the dollar is borrowed now, to try to fill the gap. And, yeah, GDP went up 5.9% clip here last quarter, but the consumer portion of GDP, the real economy, contracted. So you've got government spending more and more money to fill this gap, and this is what people aren't getting when they pay attention to these mainstream media outlets reporting on these statistics. So, you know, this is something I think is really important for people to keep their eye on. And there's plenty of people that are debunking. John Williams does a fantastic job. He takes it a lot further than we do, because that's all he does.
Right.
And he's pretty much the gold standard on debunking a lot of this stuff. But we're all doing it. And, you know, there's hundreds of authors out there that do this kind of stuff. There's newsletter writers that are doing it. So there's plenty of places where people can find the information. You just have to be willing to go out and take a look for it. I think it's very important that people do that.
Yeah.
You know, obviously, this skews investment decisions.
Yeah.
It skews allocation of capital decisions. And it serves to make the problem worse, as opposed to giving people an honest perspective on what's going on, so that people can react accordingly, make intelligent, informed decisions, and get this process kind of reversed a little bit. We're not doing anything to reverse the process. We're just exasperating everything.
Right. Well, you know, what is not also mentioned is the fact that we are a country at war. If we were not at war and all of the soldiers came home and all of the manufacturing for all of the armament stopped, what, in your opinion, and we just became a normal country, just normal, you know, normal defense, normal, however, whatever you would define as normal, what would happen to this economy, Andy?
You'd have an instant depression.
Yeah.
You know, you bring all those guys home from overseas, and there's a lot of them, and it's not just the guys in Iraq and Afghanistan. You know, we've got this Roman Empire mentality where we have outposts literally all over the globe. We have guys in Germany, we have guys in Japan, we have guys in Southeast Asia. We have military personnel all over the globe. If you stopped those operations, brought all those people home, and dumped them into the private sector, you would push wages down even further because there'd be an oversupply of labor now. Government spending would slow dramatically. So all these defense contractors who employ people, you know, some of them make things overseas, but there are people employed here in the United States because of, you know, this military spending. That would stop. And, yeah, we'd have an instant depression. The last estimates that I saw for the impact of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars, just those two, on GDP, it adds about 1.5 to 2 points to GDP.
Uh-huh.
I think that might have been a little low. I think it was, you know, realistically, it's probably more like 3 or 4 points.
Right.
But even you take 1 or 2 points and you knock that off GDP, that's causing a serious problem for us. So yeah, you can't understate the condition of war that we're in, and I think that's one of the reasons why you've seen kind of a perpetuation of this war mentality. I mean, what do we have left? We don't have any domestic manufacturing. We don't produce a lot here because of that. We've got a service economy. We have a consumer that's tapped out, buried in debt, has very little savings. What little savings they had took a huge hit in 2008. What kind of fundamentals do we have to really base any kind of global supremacy on? Well, we have this military machine.
Right. You know,
and that, I think, is going to be a theme. You're not going to see any pullout out of Afghanistan and Iraq. It's not going to happen. You know, that was campaign rhetoric to get somebody elected. That's all that was. You know, this machine is bigger than the president, and I think people need to understand that too.
Right.
You know, there's huge corporate interests involved here, and, you know, to think that, you know, a president's going to snap their fingers and just shift this paradigm, it's not going to happen, even if they wanted to do it.
Well,
but you're right. That's a huge piece of our economy is the military side of it.
So in effect, we must stay at war to keep the economy humming. I recall when I was a kid, I walked into a candy store, and I never forget this. And the guy who sold the candy was a mean SOB. I never forget. He used to scare the heck out of me. I was a little kid. And I went to buy something. I don't recall what it was, but it was made out of plastic or something like that. And it was something new, you know. And I said, geez, how come it's not made out of metal anymore or wood or whatever the case may be? And he leaned over. He says, that's because we're at war, son. I never forget him saying that. And he scared me, you know, and I ran out of the candy store. I went, Mommy, Mom, we're at war, you know. I remember that. It was like indelibly imprinted in my mind. And I don't remember stuff when I was a kid. I remember what I did, you know. And but it did leave an impression, but it makes also a point that back then we had a ration when we were at war. That was Korea. When we were in Korea, we rationed. We don't ration anymore. Now, not only don't we ration, but the president is saying, we're going to war, go out and spend. We're doing the reverse. There's something wrong with that. I mean, it like all the wires in my brain just short out. I mean, it doesn't make any sense at all. Where's all this coming from? It's like it's magically appearing. How much could we sweep under this rug before we have some real financial calamity? And when I say financial calamity, I cannot even describe that because I know not what I speak, Andy.
Well, you know what? That it's a good point that you make. And you know, going back to the war thing, I mean, if you take a look back in the, you know, the 1940s when World War II was going on, and during Korea, you know, the commercials on TV were you know, support the troops, buy war bonds, you
right.
know, basically
right.
safe.
Yeah, that's what we did.
You know, and George Bush gets on TV, I guess it was back in 2001, it was I think it was after 9/11, it might have
right.
been before, I'm not really sure on the time, I think it was, I'm pretty sure it was afterwards,
yeah.
and he told people to take a trip to Disneyland.
That's right. Yeah, I
you know,
that.
So this is a change. Yeah, you're absolutely right. Huge change in how we've well, how we address things. You know, there's no longer this idea that we need to ration anything. We just need to just go out and just blow it and be profligate and wanton in our spending habits and go into debt and do all these types of things. But you're making a good point. There are right now one and one half dozen countries that are either functionally bankrupt or on the verge of bankruptcy. This Greece situation.
Right.
Yeah, that whole deal over there, that's a drop in the bucket. And the interesting thing is you're going to find out that a lot of these Eurozone countries fudge their numbers, America style, to get into the European Union.
Oh,
Greece
right.
did it,
right.
and they did it with the help of Goldman Sachs. It's now come out. Ireland, you know, they're not in the EU yet, but Portugal, Spain, a lot of these countries, they've fudged their way into this union. And they're in a situation where their deficits were supposed to be 3% of GDP, and now they're upwards of 11, 14, 13, depending on which country you want to look at. And then you take a look at America and look at our deficit, which sits at 11, 12, 13%
right.
of GDP. And you draw the parallel, and people are starting to make the comparison and say, well, how is America any different?
Right.
Well, see, we have a printing press.
Right.
And we seem to think somehow that the possession of this printing press cloaks us in immunity from the laws of economics.
Right.
And that just doesn't happen. Not in the long run. They've gotten away with it for an exceedingly long time. But the longer they get away with it, the worse the outcome is going to be. And that's just, unfortunately, the way it works. You know, it's like a spring. You put a little weight on it, and when it rebounds, well, you know, it's not too bad. You start increasing the weight on that spring,
right.
and the rebound gets more and more wicked.
Right.
And that's what we're running into now. We're putting so much pressure on that spring. And it may not just blow all at once. It may be slow. But we're in a situation, Joe, we can't pay this debt back. It's not going to happen. There's just no way. The fundamentals aren't there. You could cut all of Social Security, and we kind of got into this before. You could cut Social Security, Medicare, and do all these types of things, confiscate the earnings of every person and corporation and what have you, and you still wouldn't be able to close this gap. We have unfunded liabilities right now that are around $70 trillion. It blows the mind. The
right.
national wealth, you know, if you take up and add the asset of every piece of land, every house, every car, every bank account, every piece of property, you're looking at about $53 or $54 trillion, depending on whose numbers you want to look at. Our liabilities are $70 trillion.
Right.
So we have a shareholder's equity, if this was a company, of about minus $16
trillion. Right.
That's our balance sheet. We're broke.
Why are other countries putting any much faith? Why do they put faith in the currency? Is that because there's no option? Is this just either their currency, which they know is crud, or ours, which is little less than crud? I mean, is it as the American Institute of Economic Research says, the Federal Reserve note is the world's tallest dwarf type thing?
Yeah, that's exactly right. You've got to look at it this way. China, who is one of the biggest contributors to this mess, because they basically provided vendor financing to the U.S. for how many years now, to a lesser extent Japan, they've exasperated this problem. They've made it a lot worse. And what you have now is a situation where you've got a bunch of countries that they wanted to develop manufacturing. So they were willing to provide vendor financing. They knew we couldn't afford it. They're not stupid. But they wanted to build a manufacturing base. So they were willing to take that gamble. And they've taken the gamble to the point now they want to start getting out of it, and they're trying to ease their way out of it. Everybody is trying to ease their way out of it. See, nobody wants to scream fire because as soon as they do, everybody's going to take a loss.
Right.
And nobody wants to be the last guy out of the theater.
That's right. They're all looking at the door. they're all looking at the door. Who's going to be the first one out, you know?
Exactly. Everybody's looking at the door, and they're kind of shuffling that direction. But nobody wants to just make the mad dash.
You're right.
Because it's in nobody's best interest for this whole thing to collapse.
Yeah.
But if you take a look at what the Fed has had to do over the past year, there's good data that suggests that the Fed had to monetize upwards, and folks, you're not going to believe this, but this is what the data looks to point at here. 80% of Treasury issues last year were monetized by the Federal Reserve. That's what the data suggests at this point. So they weren't bought by China. They weren't bought by Japan. They weren't bought by the OPEC nations. They were bought by the Federal Reserve. They were monetized,
right,
these obligations.
Well, then these...
So what?
I'm sorry.
And that's basically the end. I stepped on it. That's basically the end game of a fiat currency, is when you start monetizing. And yeah, it's covert right now, but it's not going to be for too much longer. It's just not going to be able to be concealed.
Well, the people in and around the Fed, the big financial gurus, they know this. Knowing this, you know what it. It blows my mind. Why do they persist? Why don't they come out with some sort of honest statement? Why do they continue to exasperate the situation, knowing that historically, over 4,000 years of history, it's going to happen again? I mean, you know, the definition of insanity.
Yeah. Well, see, the reason, Joe, is they profit from it. These big banks, they don't care which way markets go. They make money on both sides of the trade.
Right.
You know, where it's exceedingly difficult, and I shouldn't say exceedingly difficult, but it's a lot harder for the average little guy investor to make money on the short side of the market than it is to make money on the long side.
Right.
That's
right.
Just a function of the way the markets are set up, the laws that govern the types of risk that can be taken in different types of accounts, what have you. So the banks don't care. They make money on volatility. They make money on both sides. You know, when the markets collapsed in 2008, a lot of these guys, you know, they didn't make as much money, and they lost a lot of money because of some of the lousy risks that they had taken on. But if you look at their trading sectors, their trading departments, their trading desks made a lot of money. And there are these banks throughout history have funded both sides of different conflicts, whether they be military conflicts, whether they be economic conflicts. These guys fund both
That's
sides,
right.
And that way, no matter who wins, they win.
Yeah.
Now, and the losses are written off, and now the losses are just socialized.
Right.
The losses are passed out to the American taxpayer.
Yeah.
And I think that's the end game here. Is there, you know, you've got banking interests that are on both sides of this thing, and they're set up to win no matter what happens. So, you know, they've got an idea of where they want this whole thing to go, and that's probably a conversation for another time. But that's really what you have. It's not in the Fed's best interest, to be honest, and to say to the American people, this is the end game, and your currency is about to lose its value, because
right.
that would cause all sorts of unwanted panic,
right.
unwanted runs on banks and runs on grocery stores and
right.
you know, everything that you see happening in Greece and Iceland, and some of these other places. You know, we Americans seem to think that we're immune
right.
from all of these things
right.
because this is America, and nothing bad ever happens in America.
Right.
And this is a
bad.
Product of, you know, heavy
right.
television marketing, media, politicians, whatever. That's our mentality. We
right.
don't believe that bad things can happen here.
Yeah.
And I think it comes down to that. And I think we're in for an unpleasant reality because
yeah.
of this.
Oh, Andy.
We've built this massive pile, and we can't get out from under it.
And I have to have you back. We have less than a minute to go before we get shut down altogether, okay? Are there any closing comments
okay.
that you'd like to make or even advertise your website or your newsletter or whatever?
Well, I'm not gonna plug because you did more than was even necessary.
Okay.
I mean, I appreciate the fact
I do it on every program.
You find the publication
continue.
Useful.
Yeah. Okay. All right, Andy. Well, we got about a few seconds left. I want to thank you so much for being our guest. Folks, this was Andy Sutton, Chief Market Strategist for Sutton Associates, been our guest. The hour flew by, Andy. Could you
yes,
commit
did.
To coming back some other time again?
Absolutely. Yeah. Just get with me here and let me know when you want to do another show. We'll do another one.
I'd love
to come back.
I will do that. Okay, Andy, thank you so much. Okay? And you take care.
All right, Joe. Take care now.
Bye-bye now.
All right, bye.
Boy, that was terrific. That was absolutely terrific. Andy Sutton, he is terrific. Boy. This is the end of today's program. We'd like to thank Ranch Acres Audiology for their financial support, and we'd like to thank you for listening in. You can further the cause of liberty by recommending this program to your friends and let us hear from you. Our email address is comments@libertytalkradio.com. Remember, you're either allowing your liberties to be taken away or striving to protect them. Unfortunately, there's no middle ground. With that, until next time, I'm Joe Cristiano. This is Liberty Talk Radio. Stay well. Stay tuned.